I came in with such a rigid box of what I understood faith to be. And then when it broke down, it came back, but shaped very differently. And at the same time, it grew basements and it got expanded. And I gained capacity to comprehend and handle what I was seeing.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. If you've ever experienced real grief, and most of us have, then you know it's not really on a schedule. You don't mourn the loss of someone you love for 4 months and then it's magically done. For some of us, grief seems to come in waves, ebbing and flowing. For others, it's like a constant presence that either overwhelms us or we figure out how to live with it. And where does God factor into grief and trauma and loss? Our guest today is someone who knows about all of this intimately. I first started following him on Instagram because there seemed to be compassion and wisdom in his posts from his daily work with people in traumatic situations. J.S. Park is a hospital chaplain at Tampa General Hospital. He's the author of As Long As You Need, Permission to Grieve, part hospital chaplain experience and part memoir. I started the conversation with J.S. telling me about the immense size of Tampa Bay Hospital.
It is 1,000-plus beds, and the hospital is expanding, so I think we're going to get another 100 or 200 more beds. But we're a designated Level 1 trauma center. If you've ever seen the show The Pit or heard about it, very similar pace. So the emergency department, I would say we have usually 100 or so patients there. We have an area called the Trauma Bay, where we get Level 1 traumas, which can include gunshot wounds, car accidents, fire, fall, stabbing, drowning, electrocution, stroke. Things that require immediate assistance and support.
Yes.
And then we have palliative suites, we have cardiology, we have oncology, we have transplant. So as you can imagine, in 1,000 rooms, just all kinds of care, all kinds of specialties. And I can be in a very fast-paced setting where part of my role is to offer support and crisis assistance to a patient and or their family members as they come into the trauma bay. I establish identity. I'm the one who makes the phone call to the next of kin. Your loved one is here. As you can imagine, that is an alarming and difficult phone call to both make and to hear. Part of my role in that is to provide that cushion of safety as family arrives to the hospital. Then I get them from the front door to bedside. And then I'm also in situations where it's end of life and the pace is very different in the palliative setting or in settings where patients have more chronic illness, or are dealing with treatment that is taking quite a long time, whether that be chemo or dialysis. I'm either in situations that require a lot of immediate, fast, urgent support, or in those situations where I'm sitting and it's very still and I'm offering a listening ear. It's all the worlds. Every floor is different. Every room is different. I'm traveling to a different planet every time I step through a door. You know, the definition of a chaplain, the clinical definition, I think, a non-anxious, non-judgmental, comforting presence. And that's what I'm offering from room to room. I never know what I'm going to see. When I go into these rooms, I recognize that very often I am stepping into the worst moment of a person's life, the hardest part of their life. And so what can I do to offer a moment in the middle of swirling activity with people doing tests, with people saying, here's the diagnosis or prognosis, people offering treatment, saying numbers, saying big words. I step between the medicine and the machines, hopefully as a holy and sacred space where my patient can vent, cry, pray, scream, or be completely silent with me. And that's where I step in.
You have to be ready for anything, it sounds like, and especially at this particular hospital with traumatic cases coming in. And people who are scared are not making their best decisions or, quote, being their best selves. They are just dealing with survival in many cases. Have you learned how to decipher that, what someone really needs in that moment?
Yeah. So the joke that I make is I am a cross between a priest and a therapist or a therapriest. And maybe I should trademark that or something.
You should. Put it on your business card.
There is an intersection between mental health and faith. Therapists do a lot of the long-term care. You have priests that do a lot of the religious and spiritual support. And in a hospital where people can be praying and cussing or shouting at God and getting treatment, I sit at that intersection. Where I offer support is sometimes in that existential uncertainty and anxiety, where we're asking questions about why is this happening to me, or saying this is unfair and this is awful. And so I'm stepping in the spaces where certainly a therapist or priest could answer, but a chaplain has a specialty and a training and experience and wisdom in not imposing, in not placing like a particular therapeutic model of care, but really being able to listen and assume that what the patient carries in their infrastructure or framework of understanding, that if they have a question, they carry their own answers.
Interesting.
And so I'm holding a candle to the floor. I'm not there to proselytize or convert, but as a patient is telling me their story, we are narratively building meaning-making out of their suffering. And so I'm not so much guiding them to a conclusion, but I'm journeying with them, even if there's no conclusion. And there have been plenty of times where no questions were answered, where there may have just been screaming, grunts, and shouting, but I have been there as a presence to hear that venting. I don't judge that. All I can do is validate the non-judgmental presence.
Well, you open with the introduction of your book with almost like a Jason Bourne scenario in a way of a patient who does not know who they are, where they're from, but they know they're about to die. As I was reading that, I was wondering what went through your mind. Here's someone who's almost a blank slate, except they have a whole personality, and asking, will you remember me or will that even matter? I was just impressed with what a delicate situation, but also a chance to really be a blessing to someone, even for just a moment, you have in those situations.
Thank you. Yes. And believe it or not, that situation, I mean, having been a chaplain now 10 years, it's happened more than once. Therapists sometimes are taught to keep some sort of distance or build a therapeutic alliance over time or not self-disclose. And priests, you know, will do rituals or prayer and things like that. But what this person was really looking for was, in between all of that, a companion who would just be there and understand. Mm. And asking that question, will you remember me? That's such a deeply existential spiritual question. And that's where I feel like I step into. We do even unconventional, unorthodox things. Like, I think there's a story in the book. There was a patient who I was on the way to see another patient. So this gentleman was not my patient at all, but he was in the hallway yelling and screaming obscenities at anybody who would listen. And so I walked up to him and the question that I asked him was, is there anything that you need right now? He could tell by my face or just by my posture, just the concern in my eyes. He kind of brought it down a few levels. And even if he hadn't, that's okay. But he said, I just really want a hamburger. And so we went back to his room. And what he told me was, he said, you know, he came in through the ER and he did not expect to be admitted into the main hospital as inpatient. And he said, I feel like I'm in prison. I don't get to order my own food. You know, I really just want a good old-fashioned hamburger. So I ended up getting him a hamburger. And it was about more than that. It was about the autonomy and the choice to get the food that he wanted and not feel like he was having all his choices made for him, because he didn't expect to go from the ER to be inpatient. He felt like he was literally in a cell. And when he got the hamburger, he immediately gulped it down, had the fries, barely said thank you, you know? And then I went to the nurse later, and the nurse said, hey, what'd you do to that guy? He's so calm now. And I thought, well, part of that could be the hamburger. I'm sure the grease got to him. And at the same time, it was like he had this unmet need. Now, you could see a patient, like you see them and they could be labeled combative or non-compliant or aggressive. And sometimes those medical labels are helpful, but other times they can be a death sentence. It can cause the care team to pull away. What looks like aggression or non-compliance is a need. And sometimes that need sounds like it's something silly on the surface, but it's connected to something very spiritual and emotional and existential for them, and tied to something that they feel like they're missing or has been taken away or that suffering has impeded upon. The next day, when I got to work, I got called to a patient I was specifically asked for. The patient saw me and leaned in and said, "Hey, I heard you're the hamburger chaplain." And I said, "Well, not exactly."
Well, you can add that to therapy priest, hamburger chaplain on your card.
Yeah, that's part of my job description, you know? Yeah, here's the menu for what chaplains can get you. No, you know, and again, I don't think it ultimately was about the hamburger. It was, I need somebody to hear me.
Yeah. You've described yourself as a former atheist / agnostic. And so there's a journey there. You chose chaplaincy instead of pastoring or being a therapist. So would you talk to me about your origins and that path and getting where you got?
I grew up in a very eclectic household where my dad was Christian, my mom was atheist, my grandmother Buddhist. And so I lived in a multi-generational household, and I chose atheism very early on. I was also told very early on that I was not planned on, that the one before me was an abortion. And certainly that's their choice. At the same time, they told me, "Well, you were an accident." And that kind of informed that, well, the universe is haphazard and just completely accidental. And I don't begrudge anyone that belief, that atheism, of course. But for me, believing that the universe was kind of nihilistically cold and callous adversely affected how I navigated the world. And so I think in accordance with like being in a household that was tumultuous and turbulent and very violent, and then believing I was an accident, I'm not here on purpose, I also started believing, well, everything good that I do, I'm earning my stay. And everything bad I do, I'm disrupting the timeline, and I'm some kind of cosmic accident. So you can imagine being very young, having these wild, existential, deeply conflicting thoughts about my place in the world. And much later, I want to say around college years, young adult, found a church where they found out that I played drums and they wanted me to play for their praise team. And I asked them, "Is it a problem that I'm an atheist?" And they said, "No." So I said, "That's great.
Can you keep a tight rhythm?"
Yeah. Okay. Just keep it on the 2 and 4 and then you're good. So, you know, that was maybe their side tackle or something to, you know, they were getting me in there to hear the gospel or something like that. This church was so loving and so kind, this tiny little church. And I really, almost through the side door, extrapolating backwards, saw that the supernatural love of these people traced back to something constant and fixed and permanent that was stable, that was more stable than anything that I had grown up with, more stable than the world or people. And I found that in a world where maybe for me, things hadn't always been good, that there is a goodness at the center of it all. So I clung to that, believing that love is a real and fixed force or goodness or spirit. And so I came to Christ that way. I came to my understanding of the universe that way, from nihilistic nothingness to there is purpose. And so here I am trying to be the voice that I always needed, the ears and the heart and the hands that I always needed.
Great way to put it.
Yeah, to be told that, hey, you're on purpose. I tried to do church ministry, I think for almost 7 years in youth ministry. You know, having grown up an atheist and then you start working at a church, you start finding out, I was looking at at scripture and then looking at the church and going, hey, there's a little bit of a mismatch here, you know? I always felt like I was on the outside of looking through a window and just felt like an oddball. Like, are you guys sure we're supposed to be doing it this way? You know, when I'm reading scripture, there's something, you know, misaligned. And when I went to seminary, I felt like I was constantly catching up. Like, oh, I better read the Bible and, oh, I better understand these inside jokes and how church is supposed to go and what a pastor is. And I tried almost 7 years and I always just felt kind of odd outside of it. Somebody had told me about chaplaincy while I was a pastor. And they were like, oh yeah, it's kind of like being a pastor, but at the hospital. And you're not trying to build a church or build numbers or all that kind of stuff. I remember filing that away, not exactly the back of my brain, maybe middle of my brain, and just thinking, oh, that sounds like paradise. And then when I got into chaplaincy, gosh, it was a whole different world. And I can tell you that the difference between being a pastor and a chaplain, pastors spend quite a bit of time imparting information and theology, preaching in a pulpit, and trying to ensure that their people are given a theology and framework for their life, whereas chaplains act as a presence. So if pastors preach, chaplains are a presence. If somebody tells you something painful, don't start preaching right away. Mm. You just listen and you sit with. And so that's been the big shift for me. And early on, that was tough. But 10 years on, here I am and fully happy to be where I'm at.
This is In Good Faith. I'm speaking with J.S. Park, chaplain at Tampa General Hospital and author of As Long As You Need. You can hear more stories about grief and healing in our mini-series on death, especially in episode 221 with Bishop Phyllis Spiegel and episode 222 with Jules Olson, a hospice chaplain. Find all our episodes on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and share an episode that's meant something to you with the people you love.
Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show. And you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now more from J.S. Park.
I feel like I could pull two or three quotes from any chapter, and it could be a worthwhile discussion. Here's one that really struck me. You said, speeding through grief always has a cost. It's a voice that must speak. And in my notes, I put, it will speak one way or another. You could express it now, or if you don't and you tamp it down, it's still going to result in something in your life. People don't do that on the schedule. And yet, it feels like for the comfort of others, we feel like, oh, can you be done with that really hard part? Because, you know, we used to like hanging out with you and now you're right. And that it is okay maybe for some people to go a little more quickly through that. But just the idea that you get to grieve as you need to is, I think, a really important point you make. And you've seen so much of that in traumatic situations that I just feel like, well, here's a voice of authority telling me this from experience.
When I see that, you know, that's the thing that used to make me really angry. When I would see a friend or family or even a pastor who was visiting this patient and family, and they would say things that would rush someone towards hope and healing and finally landing in a place where they're not sad anymore, as if that were the goal, as if the end goal of grief is supposed to be, we're now at the summit, flowers, sunlight, you know, and we're at peace. And that has a lot to do, like you said, with my own discomfort or someone's own discomfort at seeing someone else's pain. It used to make me angry, but now, and I say this in the book too, sort of like where I landed on that is, I have a lot of compassion for folks who rush someone else past their grief because there is a compassion for someone when you see them in pain, you want to say something into the pain to try to get them past it, rush them past the abyss of loss. Because you see them in pain and you think, I got to say something to fix this.
To be helpful.
Right. And that's a very human impulse and instinct to want to do that. Or if things are too quiet or if things are too hard, I have to say something. And there is this natural, maybe indoctrinated teaching that we all have of, I'm going to just smooth this person over to something hopeful and helpful with positivity, with cliches, with a one-liner, with a lecture, with a lesson, so that they're not hurting anymore. What's hard for both people is to sit in and be with and feel all the pain that they're experiencing. So for me to be a good chaplain or for me to be a good comfort or presence, I need to be able to look it in the face and say, this hurts because it meant something, because this loss is hard and there's no way around that. There's no fast way around it. Sometimes when I'm in a room, Steve, I navigate these complicated family dynamics. Sometimes there's 10, 20 people in a room. You can imagine sometimes I'm in a waiting room, it's packed wall to wall. And you'll have people at different tempos and levels of what they can accept and tolerate. And you may have one person who is really leaning in and saying, like, I see you, I know that you're hurting, do whatever you need to. But then you may have four or five people that'll say things like, well, everything happens for a reason and God's got this and don't ask for a lighter load, get a stronger spine, be strong, don't cry, you'll be okay. You know, all those things where they're pulling that future eschatological curtain of hope and just smothering over their present suffering because they think it's helping. And what I have to do is balance all of this as a chaplain. And sometimes I'll say one or two things that will give permission for the people who feel like they can't weep and vent to be able to express everything that they're really feeling. And if they see a chaplain do that, suddenly they go, oh, I didn't know it was okay to do that. You feel the room go, oh, we're allowed to say that, that's okay.
Like
it takes a delicate balance.
We can be real. Yeah.
Yes, let's be honest about what's going on.
Some people can't handle that, I think.
Yeah.
To be honest, because of the way my faith works, the worst grief I've had has not been losing elderly people I love to death. I miss them, but I've found myself rejoicing in their lives. The hardest grief for me to deal with has come in choices made by loved ones or things out of our control that have happened to my loved ones. And there have been a few times when I could not figure out how I could keep living my life while feeling how I felt. In my case, it was reaching out to Jesus and saying, I can't do this alone, and actually feeling like I cast this burden on him, someone much stronger than me. And it seemed he took some of that weight and helped carry it.
There is a cost to grief. And as I read through this, you've had to pay a little bit of that cost yourself from hearing just so much of it. What I read is a really transformational thing that somebody actually had to point out to you that you were not doing very well, and they called it cumulative grief that was starting to affect your mental health. Do you mind walking us through that?
Yeah, there was a cumulative grief, a vicarious grief or vicarious trauma that I was experiencing. You know, for healthcare workers, for frontline responders, there is a point, a tipping point. There's the one incident or one event that tips us over. And it's too much for our psyche, our spirit, our soul, our mental health to handle. And that happens for everybody. And I detail this in the book, I think in chapter 2. I did lose my faith about 13 months in. And I came back around, but very changed. I have lost my faith a couple times since then. And each time I come back, it's different. I came in with such a rigid box of what I understood faith to be. And then when it broke down, it came back, but shaped very differently. And at the same time, it grew basements and it got expanded. And I gained capacity to comprehend and handle what I was seeing. When you see the extent and severity of suffering that people go through, it really challenges what you believe about the goodness of the world and about, is there a God who really is up there orchestrating, or is God pulling strings, or is God apathetic to what we're going through? I wish I could tell you like, oh, and then finally one day woke up and, you know, I now have an A+ in theology.
We always love to hear the story. Like, let me tell you the story of how I fixed everything.
Yeah.
But we're not usually really there yet.
No, you know, and even in the book, I left it a little bit open-ended about where I landed, and that was very intentional because it's still somewhat open-ended for me. And one of the negative reviews on Amazon was something like, oh, he never got his faith back. And I thought, well, I tried to detail it in a very subtle way, but I didn't want anyone to think, oh, eventually when you come back around, you come back to faith stronger than ever. It isn't quite like that. It's become more pliable, more open, more flexible, and maybe more breakable, but there's something about that I need to be able to get through this work. I'm so glad that I work with amazing people, amazing chaplains. I go to therapy. My family's amazing. That they can hold me through these times where there'll be a visit that will deeply, deeply impact me and I take it home. Mm. I mean, how could I not?
Yeah.
I can't compartmentalize it. But there are people who will hold me through it and will not try to contradict that and will just say, yeah, that's awful that that could happen, and it did. We hold each other through that, and that's how I see the love of God these days, where the love of God does not take away from or gloss over or smooth over what happens, but can hold us through the hardest of it.
I think one thing that made the book attractive for me to read, in spite of the difficult situations, was that you were very real in also presenting mistakes. You sort of apologize at one point for maybe having made a mistake. And this is just such a beautiful story to me, which was a lady who was dying and thought you were her son.
It was such a deeply sad encounter. But this patient, she had dementia. She thought I was her son. And I didn't have the heart at the very end of her life to tell her that I wasn't. And I still question it. I mean, should I have oriented her back to reality? Should I have let her know, like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not your son, and maybe disappointed her at the end? But when she finally did transition to the other side, she just seemed so at peace because she really believed her son came to see her. And I know that people may disagree with what I did with that. One thing I have noticed, Steve, and I feel like as we're talking about this, this came to mind. You know, these kinds of conversations about death and loss and grief, I never expected to be able to write a book like this. But on my social media, anytime I've written a post about loss, I'm always surprised by the amount of people that respond and engage with it. And what that tells me, I think, is that people are ready to have this conversation. There's maybe still a lot of fear around mortality naturally, but at the same time, let's have the talk about how do we have dignity in our dying? How do we validate and honor our grief? What are the things I can do with this grief? What does healthy grief look like? Just the fact that we're having this conversation, people are interested, people want to talk about it. And even if it's scary, people are ready to talk about it. And I just hope for anyone listening that we each can become the safety for another person's pain to say, hey, anytime you're hurting, anytime you're grieving, I'm a safe person. There may be a lot of people who rush you past it, but I'm going to go at your speed and your tempo. The hope for this book is to create that sort of safety, or at least stir some ideas about how can we be safe. The fact that this book is out, and the fact that people want to read it and talk about it, and the fact that you and I are talking, it's showing me, hey, we're ready for this conversation. I am a safe person to be able to have it with you.
Many thanks to J.S. Park for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Heidi Clough, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, in Good Faith.
There is power in stories. They inspire us. They help us see ways we might try doing things. And sometimes a story will even tell us not to go down that particular path. And it's nice to learn that from a story or a conversation before you experience it yourself. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here from the In Good Faith podcast. I love stories because what they teach me about people, about God, about politics, about everything. And I hope you will check out the brand new podcast, Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. There is so much to learn from the stories of these guests because they are people who found themselves in an uncomfortable moment. They could have just left the situation, written off the people they disagreed with, but instead they made something beautiful out of it. And you can learn how, and I know you'll like the stories. This is hosted by Julie Rose, the host of Top of Mind. She does a great job, and I know you'll love the guests and their stories. Check out Uncomfy.